pray, and then we'll get started.
God, thank you for the awesome day that we have today, God, and for every generation that's represented here. And I just pray that as we hear from you today, God, that the words that I speak, they would be your words. I pray that all of our hearts would be receptive to what it is that you want to say. And God, I just pray that you would help us to be wide awake as well, God, that you would help us to really capture what it is that you want to speak into our lives today. And I thank you that your Spirit enables that. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, I want to start off today with a quote from a college football coach. See, he was pressed to explain his coaching philosophy, and what he said was this: there's just three things I ever say to my players. If anything goes bad, then I did it. If anything goes semi-good, then we did it. And if anything goes real good, then you did it. What a motivational philosophy, isn't it? Could you imagine if every single generation in the church embraced that philosophy and lived their life with that philosophy? If every single generation in the church said, if anything goes bad, then I did it. And if it's kind of good, then we did it. And if it was really good, then you did it. What if every generation in the church took responsibility for the outcome of what God wanted to do? What if every generation, when something was happening, if there was a youth event and it didn't really work out, nobody showed up or only a few people showed up, what would happen if the teenager said, you know what? It was our fault. We take responsibility because we believe that God wanted to do something and we didn't do our part. God didn't show up and it was because of us. If they took responsibility for what God wanted to do, what would happen if every generation celebrated God moving through another generation? What would happen if the 20-somethings and the 30-somethings saw that God really did move at that youth event and celebrated the awesomeness of what the youth were able to do, what the youth allowed God to do through them? What if the teenagers or the children could look at the 40-somethings and say, wow, look at what God is doing through them. I just want to be a part of it so much. I just want to know what it is they have. What experience in life did they have to go through to get to the place where they're sensitive enough to allow God to move through them in such a way? How can I do that right now in my life? What would happen if we did that? What would happen if every generation lived like that? I know Mark has stood up here in the past and even recently, and he's made comments about how some people have shared that, you know, I think that maybe we focus too much on this generation, or why don't we focus enough on this generation? And his response has been, well, you know, sometimes when you focus on the one segment, you kind of need to overcompensate to get back on the road. And I wonder sometimes if we even have to ask the question, are we overcompensating? And if we do have to ask the question, why are we asking the question? Are we asking the question because we see a generation or group of people that aren't getting the focus they deserve, that aren't getting the focus they needed, that aren't being opened to the possibilities and the potentials that they have inside of them? Are we asking because of that? Are we asking because we're concerned that our own generation isn't getting the focus and the attention that we need? What is the motivation there? It's really easy. I know many of you would say that I'm still young. And that's fine. I'm not going to disagree with you. But as I am getting older, I don't think I'm old yet, but as I'm getting older, I find that it's easy to almost feel threatened by some of the other people who are coming up after me. It's easy to feel like, is my role really secure? Am I still going to be able to do this? Am I still going to be able to do that? Will they still schedule me on the worship team when there's so many other guitarists, some of whom are smaller than their guitars? Not mentioning any names. But really, it's easy to feel that we could be threatened by a generation that's coming up because we see that they can do things better than us. Or what could be even more scary is that we actually see they have the potential to do something better than us. And then what would we do, right? I want to read you a story. Unfortunately, it's 8 chapters of the Bible. So I'm not going to read the whole thing because you would probably be put to sleep by my monotone voice as I droned on. But what I will do is I'm going to read you a couple segments of it, and I want to encourage you. You know, the Old Testament is often not an easy thing to read. It can be really confusing sometimes. I find it confusing sometimes. But this particular story is actually really a really easy read, and it's a really great story. And it starts in Genesis 37, and it's about a guy by the name of Joseph. And so we're going to pick it up here in Genesis 37, verse 1. And I want to encourage you, it's about 8 chapters, they're short chapters, and it really is an easy read. If you've ever picked up a book of short stories or read a short story, it's a lot like that. But a lot happens in these 8 chapters. So, Genesis 37, verse 1, it says, Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, in the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah. Great names. Those were his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. So he's in the field, tending to some animals, and his brothers are not doing a very good job, so he comes back and he kind of tells on them. So, now Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made him a richly ornamented robe. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. His brother said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. Listen, he said, I had another dream. And this time, the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told his father, as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. You need to understand the culture of the day in that the parents were at the top of the hierarchy, and then the firstborn son, and then down the ranks. And Joseph, being the youngest, would have been at the bottom of the totem pole. He was not a high-ranking person in the family. And so for him to stand in front of his family and say, you guys are actually going to bow down to me, would be like heresy, right? You wouldn't hear somebody talking like that. And so it's understandable that his brothers couldn't stand him. And it's understandable that his father actually got a little bit upset as well. But here's the interesting thing. As the story goes on, I'm going to give you kind of a recap of the next 8 chapters. So his brothers didn't like him. They couldn't say anything nice about him. And one day they're out doing some stuff, and Joseph's father, Jacob, sends Joseph out to his brothers. And he's with his richly ornamented robe, right? You could almost make a musical or something from that story. But he goes out to see his brothers, and his brothers see him coming from a distance, and they say, let's kill him. Let's just get rid of him. He's annoying. We don't like him. Let's just get rid of him, and we'll just tell our father that some wild animal, you know, took him or something like that. So he ends up getting saved. One of his brothers kind of sticks up for him, sort of, but they beat him up, and then they sell him to some traders that just happen to be passing by, and they sell him as a slave. And then they take his nice coat, they kill an animal, they put some blood all over it, they tear it up, and they bring it back to the father and say, he's dead. This is what we found. We didn't see him. We just found this. So Joseph, sold to these traders, they go down to Egypt and they sell Joseph to a guy by the name of Potiphar. And he's sold as a slave and he serves in that household. And then through an unfortunate series of events, Joseph is wrongly accused by Potiphar's wife and ends up getting put in jail, right? And so he's in jail, and in jail, he's stuck there. But the interesting thing is that at both in both Potiphar's house and in jail, both the warden and Potiphar recognize that there's something about Joseph, and that there's something going on with him, because everything he does seems to go well with him. And Potiphar puts him in charge of his entire house so that he can also benefit from, you know, Joseph's good fortune, which we know is just God's hand blessing him. And then the warden sees the same thing. He sees that Joseph is just, there's something about him, something that's really just, everything just seems to work well for him. So he basically kind of puts Joseph in charge of the prison. Now, Joseph is still in prison, so it's kind of like the best of the worst situations. It's not glorious, but at least it's a little bit better. So he's in prison in Egypt. And then all of a sudden, Pharaoh, the guy who's running the whole country, has a dream that nobody can interpret. Nobody can understand. And so they call Joseph. And Joseph comes and he interprets the dream. And Pharaoh puts him in charge of the entire country. The dream goes like this. There were some grain that came, seven stalks of grain that came forth, and they were humongous. And then after them came basically seven really lousy harvests. And the same with some cows as well. And Joseph interprets the dream as, you know what this means is that there's going to be, from this point forward, 7 years where the land is going to be incredibly fruitful. The harvests are going to be humongous. We're going to have a lot. But after that, there's going to be another 7 years of famine. And it is going to be the worst famine you have ever seen. There is going to be nothing. The ground is not going to give any food at all. So he interprets these dreams, and Pharaoh puts him in charge of the country to manage all the country's resources so that Egypt can survive the next 14 years. In Genesis 42, Joseph's family, remember, they think he's dead, come to Egypt to get food because the famine is really bad and there's no food even outside of Egypt, and everybody knows Egypt has food. So they come to buy food from Egypt. Joseph, who's in charge of all of this, decides he's going to play a little bit of head games because he recognizes his brothers, but his brothers don't recognize him. So he kind of gives them a little bit of a hard time and sends them on their way. And then a few chapters later, he reveals his true identity to his family. Some parts of the story not affecting the outcome have been omitted. So, it's a really interesting story. And, you know, to give you an idea, when we look at the nation of Israel, this is where it started. When Israel could be measured with a handful of people, this is that moment. This is that family, right here. This is where Israel was born. This is where their nation began. It's where they started. It's also where the starting point for where Israel eventually becomes slaves to Egypt. And you know the whole story where Moses says, "Pharaoh, let my people go." This is the starting point of that as well. So it's interesting when Joseph was allegedly killed. His brothers told his father that he was dead. And listen to this, Genesis 37, verses 34 and 35. It says, "Then Jacob tore all his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. All of his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. No, he said, in mourning I will go down to the grave to my son. So his father wept for him." It's interesting. In chapter 43, that was chapter 37. In chapter 43, you find that Jacob never stopped mourning the loss of Joseph. He was still broken about it. He was still upset. He was still withdrawn. And actually, he became protective of his next youngest son. And, you know, I think part of the reason that Jacob was so protective of Joseph and then later his next son, I almost wonder if it's because Jacob saw something in that younger generation. He saw something in them, and he knew that there was going to be something about them that was going to change. That was going to change things. It was going to impact the world in a way. He might not have had an understanding of what that was, but I think Jacob actually recognized that there was something in that younger generation that was monumental, that was humongous, that was going to have a significant impact. And what I find even more amazing is that in chapter 45, Joseph reveals himself to his family. He says, "Hey, I'm actually your younger brother. I'm Joseph." And the very first question Joseph asks his brothers is my father still alive? It's the very first question. And I almost wonder if Joseph himself saw something in the older generation. If Joseph saw something that he didn't quite understand, but he knew he had to have. He saw some type of connection maybe with God, saw some type of potential that he wanted, that he didn't quite have yet, but he knew that he needed, and he could only get it from that generation. I think he saw something significant in the life of his father that would change his own life. And he still wanted to grab hold of that. And there was a lot of areas of Joseph's life that were not very well disciplined, that could have used a little bit of work. The most obvious one to me is his communication skills. Some things you should say with reservation, and there's some things you should not vocalize. I think Joseph learned that eventually, but there was definitely some things in his life that weren't perfect. And I know I've heard this story so many times, and a lot of people have told me that, well, God had to make Joseph's life miserable because Joseph maybe was arrogant or this or that. I don't really know about that. Because when I look at Joseph's life, I see somebody who's actually very hardworking. Outside of Potiphar's wife, he was never accused of doing anything bad. He was never accused of doing anything wrong, right? And then interestingly, Potiphar's wife, she described him as attractively strong. Think about that for a second, ladies. Attractively strong. And now come back. Okay. Now, his brothers, he's out in the field, and he comes back home, and he says to his father, you know what, they're not really doing a very good job. And what do his brothers say? Well, they actually don't say anything at all. I think it's because it was true. They weren't doing a very good job. They didn't say, oh, that's not true. We were working hard. They didn't say that. Probably because Joseph was telling the truth. And then they didn't even say, it was actually Joseph who wasn't pulling his weight. We were doing all the work. Joseph's a slacker. I mean, he's young. Obviously, we're the older people, the more mature. We're obviously the harder working ones. I don't think that was the case. I think Joseph was the hardworking one. Think about it. Everywhere Joseph went, he was basically put second in command. He's sold as a slave, and he's put in second in that household. That means he managed the entire household. I worked at McDonald's for 10 years, and by the time I left, my position was what you would call a first assistant store manager. So I wasn't quite a store manager. I didn't get the company car. I would have if I just maybe stayed a little bit longer, but, you know, first assistant store manager. So there was the store manager, he ran the store, and then there was me. And I know from experience that I basically ran the whole store, right? Now, I didn't have to answer for everything that went wrong. Kind of a good position to be in. But I still, I had almost as much responsibility as the person who was in charge, and that was Joseph. He was put in second. He was the first assistant, the second in command. Everywhere he went, he's sold as a slave, he's second. He gets thrown in prison, he gets put in second. Years later, he gets put second in command of what was probably the most powerful country in the world of the time. We don't think much of Egypt now, but back then, Egypt was a force to be reckoned with. Think about the most powerful country you know, I'm not going to give you any suggestions because it's open to interpretation. Think of the most powerful country you know. That wasn't even a joke. But think of the most powerful country you know, and then imagine somebody my age running it. Because Joseph was 30 when he was put in that position. And I'm only 31. So imagine that. That's crazy, isn't it? There's an election coming up in a few days. Imagine if I was then running the country. Isn't it scary? I think it's scary. Vote Dave. Don't vote for me. I'm not even running. All right. So I believe that Joseph was actually a very hardworking person. And you know what's interesting is that Joseph and Jesus have a lot of parallels. There's a lot of things about Jesus or about Joseph that are the same with Jesus. Joseph was the son that the father loved the most. And so was Jesus. Right? Joseph was rejected by his own, much like Jesus. And Joseph was a foreigner in the land that he lived in. And they said of Jesus, he's from Nazareth. Can anything good come from Nazareth? Joseph saw that his family would bow down to him, and the Bible says that everyone will bow to Jesus. And here's the thing, is that people came to Joseph as their source for natural food, for natural energy. And we know that Jesus is the ultimate source, spiritually, for life. But even through all of that, Joseph was very much a normal person. He was really no different than yourself or me. He was a normal person. He was somebody who, in his life, had a lot of things go wrong. He was what we would call buffeted. If you've ever had somebody come and push you, they're just hitting you. And you kind of go back a bit, and then you kind of take another step forward and straighten your shirt up and look up, and then they hit you again. That's buffeted. Every time you just pick yourself back up, they hit you again. And that was Joseph's life. Every single time he thinks, this is it. I've arrived. This is going really good. He gets hit down again. I just got this really nice robe, and now my brothers are beating on me. That's okay. They were going to kill me. Now they're not. Fantastic. Oh, wait. Now they're selling me as a slave. Okay, good. It's working out for me. I'm kind of running the whole show here now at this guy's house. Oh, now I'm in prison. That's great. And then I actually omitted this from the story, but there was actually an opportunity for Joseph to get out of prison, and it didn't work. some of Pharaoh's servants were thrown in the prison as well, and he interpreted their dreams and says, now, could you just do me a favor and remember me? So maybe since you're a servant who serves Pharaoh directly, maybe you could put in a good word and I could get out of here? No, not really. It was actually years later before the servant even remembered, oh yeah, there's that guy Joseph. He interpreted my dream. Maybe he can interpret yours too. Right? So Joseph was buffeted. One thing after another went wrong in his life. What was remarkable is that Joseph made the most out of every single opportunity. He didn't let the circumstances sway his life. He decided that whatever cards he was going to be dealt, he would play them as best he could. And it didn't matter what they were. This happens a lot in our lives. We wonder, why can't I pay my rent? Why am I struggling so much? And then all of a sudden, we seem to find this financial blessing, we call it, and money comes in, but then something else goes wrong and our car breaks down and now we're right back where we started. And over and over and over again, the price of gas goes up and now I can't even afford to drive to work. The price of groceries go up. The market is a little bit unstable and I lose a significant chunk of my retirement investment. One thing after another after another. A huge rainstorm and now my roof is leaking and now I have to put a new roof on my house. Whatever it is, it's one thing after another. But here's what's really remarkable. When Joseph's family came to him, and Joseph revealed himself, his brothers were terrified. Think about it. The younger brother you had been picking on, the younger sibling you had been picking on your whole life, and all of a sudden, he's leading the most powerful country in the world, and you need his help. I can only imagine what was going through their heads. But you know what's interesting is what Joseph said to them. He said, you know what? Don't worry about what happened. Don't worry about the things you did to me. That's not important. You know what? I recognize that everything that happened in my life was God directing me. Everything that you did, all the circumstances, all the situations, was God funneling me to this one point, to this one moment in time. All the negative things that happened to me, it wasn't negative things. It was God leading me to this exact moment in time, this very moment right here where you're standing in front of me and I'm standing right here. It's this very moment that God put me on this earth so that I could provide you with food so that you could survive. This is my purpose, and I recognize this now. This is what I'm here for. This is why I'm here, so I can provide for you. It's interesting that if Joseph hadn't have done that, then his family probably would have starved to death. We wouldn't even know about a nation called Israel. And that's the same nation that Jesus came through. It's the same family lineage. Isn't it interesting how God weaves himself into our own lives? That God's unique plan fits intricately into what we want to do. And we think that things are going wrong in our life, but things aren't going wrong in our life. God is directing us to the precise moment in time where we can finally step into one spot, one moment, and realize that this is our potential. This is it. This is why I'm here. And all of a sudden, just like Joseph, generations are affected. People are changed. Joseph provided food for his family, and he gave them a new life. I think there was probably a moment in Joseph's life where maybe he wasn't wide awake, just like we saw in that advertisement. There might have been a moment in Joseph's life where, you know what, he didn't recognize what God was trying to do, where he looked at all the things going on in his life. He's like, I don't really understand it. And I'm sure that there are times when he probably thought he would rather not be there. But imagine what would have happened if he had just given up. But I think at some point, and I don't even know that it was when he actually met his family. I think it happened before then. At some point, Joseph's eyes opened, and he became wide awake, and he recognized the potential for his life and the purpose for the reason that he was on the planet. He realized that his life wasn't just about him. It wasn't just about his generation, but it was about everybody in his generation. It was about everybody who was coming after him, and it was about everybody who came before him. What's remarkable is that Joseph, we would say Joseph didn't work for Christians. And Joseph lived in what would have been considered a very pagan land. The Egyptians didn't serve the God of Israel. They didn't serve the true and living God. It would have just been Joseph. Only Joseph. That's it. Nobody else, just him. One person decided to connect with God and stay connected with God. And he had a remarkable experience. And it affected generations. Maybe your life will only affect 12 people. Maybe it will affect thousands, maybe millions. We don't know. But just like God's plan to introduce Jesus as man's savior was integrated into this plan, God's plan for you is no less important. Your unique plan is for you. And you know what? You might not recognize it, but there are people who are coming after you that are going to be affected. They're going to be affected by what you do. They're going to be affected by your decisions you make and whether you choose to live your life wide awake or not. From one person, an entire nation was born. Now, Joseph recognized one really important thing. And that's that knowledge requires action. I want to show you this. Joseph is just wrapping up his interpretation of Pharaoh's dream in Genesis 41, starting at verse 31. This is what he says. The abundance in the land will not be remembered because the famine that follows it will be so severe. The reason the dream was given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. Now listen to this. And now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land. Take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in the cities. In other words, things are going to be so good for the next 7 years. Let's take one fifth of it and stockpile it. So that at the end of 7 years, when we don't have any more food, we have food. What's interesting is that Joseph was called to Pharaoh's room to interpret the dream. And he finished interpreting the dream at verse 32. But he didn't stop talking. Pharaoh didn't even get a chance to get a word in edgewise here. Immediately, Joseph says, and now let Pharaoh look for someone. Someone who's wise and discerning, who can run the land. He immediately brought Pharaoh to a place where the knowledge that he had required immediate action. James 4:17 says that if anyone knows the good he ought to do, doesn't do it, he sins. I know sin is a little bit of a weird word in our North American culture, so let me rephrase it in the Dave Zakos version. Anyone who knows the good that they ought to do and doesn't do it, does the wrong thing. If you know the right choice, if you know what the right choice is, and you choose not to do it, you've made the wrong choice. Right? If you know what you're supposed to do, and you choose that you're not going to do it, you've chosen the wrong thing. That's bad. Right? So when we have information, when we have knowledge, it is incumbent upon us to act on that. It is incumbent upon us to share that information. It's not incumbent upon the person who doesn't know to ask, because they don't know that they don't know. It's in the workforce, if you're a trainer or you're a coach, one of the things they say to you is, don't ever ask somebody, do you understand? Because the answer will 9 out of 10 times be yes. Because people only understand what they understand. If they misunderstood, then they understand the misunderstanding. And they think they understand, but they really don't. But they genuinely believe they understand. They just don't. And they don't know to say that I don't know, because they don't know that they don't know. So the onus is on us, right? You have to say to that person, do you understand? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. Great. Now show me. Or now explain it to me. Explain the math formula to me. Explain it. Explain why this sentence is grammatically incorrect. Explain it to me. Help me understand. If you say you know it, show me that you know it. Right? We have to coach people along the process, not just assume that they know. And if we have information that can help another generation or another group of people, the onus is on us to act. The onus is on us to give that information and to make it available. I've been at the church, at this community, for I think almost 15 years. I think I'm in my 14th now. It's so much fun. I've just lost track of time. But in the process there, I joined the worship team. I was thinking about it. I joined the worship team like a decade ago, I think, or thereabouts, pretty close. When I joined the worship team, we got the schedule, and it was handwritten on a piece of graph paper and photocopied. I thought, okay, that's great. I know when I'm playing. But then somebody came along with the ingenious idea that we could throw it into a spreadsheet, so that when people's schedules change at the last minute, we can just swap out names. We don't have to use whiteout or scratch things out. And we can reprint it, and it'll look really clean and crisp and clear. And so that's what we do. Right? And then, through the course of the years of being on the worship team, some new people have come and some people have gone. But I've noticed that even though Andrew kind of sets some standards for the worship team, such as take your music off your stands, wrap up your cables. If you've brought equipment, take it off the stage. Even though he lets people know, sometimes people forget. And that's in a sense, it's almost understandable because, you know, if you tell your children to do something once, do you ever have to tell them again? Yeah. And it could work with husbands and wives, I suppose, too. So, you know, it's as somebody who's been on the team a long time, you know, it's my responsibility to set an example. And to, in a loving and gracious and kind way, remind these individuals that they need to clean up their area, right? Because they probably just don't remember. So the onus is on us who have knowledge to impart that knowledge and to act on what we know. I'm using some really simple examples here. But you could apply this to everything. You know, if you've been a follower of Christ for decades, then you should have a really good understanding of how to relate to people and share your faith, more so than somebody who's only been a follower of Christ for 8 months or a year. You have that information. You know what? You should impart that information. You should share that information with people. Imagine how much more effective they could be by knowing that. The other thing is that action doesn't happen by accident. It needs to be deliberate, right? Joseph was very deliberate in telling Pharaoh that he needed to do something. You need to act now, Pharaoh. You need to make a choice because God's going to do this and he's going to do it soon, right? We need to make a choice that we're going to be moved to action. And I often even wonder sometimes if being deliberate can actually breed a true respect and thankfulness between generations. Really, when people can genuinely see that you're interested in their success, when you're genuinely interested in their improvement, I think that can genuinely breed a sense of thankfulness and appreciation. At one of my previous jobs, I worked with somebody. We were a team. There was two of us. And we worked to manage a group of people. And this individual really loved to show their affection for me. And they did so by, on a regular basis, pointing out the areas of my life and my management style that could use some refinement. I appreciated it, and I interpreted their actions of affection as how they communicate. So therefore, I, in turn, showed affection towards them by also pointing out the areas of their life and their management style that could use some refinement. And we laugh, but you know what? That person had a genuine vested interest in my success. We joke back and forth sometimes, but you know what? I genuinely wanted to hear how I sucked. I mean, we don't really want to hear it at the time, but you know, I got to be honest. It made me a better manager at that moment. And my ability to communicate with that individual made them better. And I was able to say, hey, this is the report I've done, or how do you think I handled that meeting? Can I get some feedback? Is there ways that I could improve so that the next time I have to have a meeting like that, I can be more effective? But I thought that was interesting. This person was a little bit older than me. I don't think they joked that they were much older than me, but numerically, they weren't that much older than me. It was more than 10 years, but you know, but I thought it was great that they were interested in my success, and I appreciated it. And I'm sure that they appreciated the same thing that I would want to look out for them. But the thing is that person was not accidental about the feedback. They were very much deliberate about it. They didn't wait for me to say, hey, how did I do? They said, oh, by the way, about that meeting, or about this report, or about the way that's phrased in this report, I think maybe, what would happen if you said it this way? They took action. They didn't wait for me to give feedback. They went and did it. Now, let me show you something in the scripture here. Genesis 45. This is when Joseph is sharing to his brothers. It says this, in Genesis 45, beginning at verse 4, it says, then Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. When they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will not be plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. Imagine if we could live our lives with that mindset alone. Where we don't even think about all the horrible things that are going on in our lives. We just focus on God and what God wants to do. He made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me. You, your children, and your grandchildren, your flocks and herds, and all you have. Notice the multi-generation right there. I will provide for you there because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all who belong to you will become destitute. I think this is a really good illustration that regardless of how we felt in the past, it's time to just move on and reach out to other generations. That regardless of the things that other people have done to us, we should forgive them and move on. Regardless of the circumstances or situations or how we felt about under 30s Sunday or how we felt about April last year, regardless of how we felt about any other month or any other event or any other circumstance or situation, anything people have done to us at any point in time ever, we should forgive them and move on and press on to what God wants to do. Because we don't even know if God was speaking through somebody when they made that comment that we were really upset about and haven't talked to them since. We don't know. Maybe that was actually God talking to us. Maybe that's why we got so upset, because it cut to the heart so much. We don't know. But it's time to move on. Genesis 45, 25, we're skipping down a few verses. So they went up out of Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. They told him, Joseph is still alive. In fact, he is ruler of all Egypt. Jacob was stunned. He did not believe them. But when they told him everything Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts Joseph had sent to carry him back, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. I have no doubts in my mind. Not one, that Joseph's family was incredibly grateful for Joseph, especially at that moment. They were really thankful for what he was doing and for the provision he was making, because he could have just as easily ordered them all executed or ordered them all banished out of the land. Or he could have sent their army after them to destroy them all. He could have done whatever he wanted. He chose to help. I have no doubt that they were thankful. And I have no doubt that Joseph himself was thankful for his family, despite what they did. And I think it's interesting that Joseph brought his entire family to himself. I think it shows us that generations need to be together. Now, we don't have to have multiple generations living in the same household. That would be an interesting dynamic in our culture. But I think it shows us that there's an element of staying together across the generations and working together that is really valued and very important. And I think we need to be appreciative and thankful for each generation's unique contribution. The younger generation, the teens, the children, the 20-somethings, even the 30-somethings need to be appreciative of the people who are older and more mature, who have more life experience, who have gone through more, who have wisdom that these younger people probably could use, right? People who are probably in your late 20s and 30s, you've probably just started to realize that if you knew now, you know, if you knew then what you know now, how life would have been so different, right? If I'd just known when I was a teenager about this, oh man. And I'm not even talking about lottery numbers. I'm just talking about simple stuff. Like, if I had just known how to manage my money when I was a teenager, man, I wouldn't have even had to take out a mortgage. Could you imagine that? Wow, how much your life would have changed? There's things in the older generation that we need to be appreciative for. And there's things in the younger generation, there's potential that the older generation needs to be thankful for and appreciate. We're going to close in a minute with a video. But I want to make a couple last points. In the passage we just read, when Jacob found out that Joseph was alive, it said his spirit was revived. And it's an interesting word, revived. It doesn't mean regenerated. It means revived. But that word is used elsewhere in the Old Testament to describe people coming back from the dead. Think about the change. Jacob was very much alive. Think about the change in Jacob's spirit, in his heart, that the word used to describe that was going from being stone cold dead to being a live, living, breathing person. That's how radical the change was in his spirit. Hope is regenerating. Joseph was an individual who took responsibility for what God was doing in his generation. Remember, we started with that. We said, what if every generation took responsibility for what God wanted to do, or what God was doing, or what God was not able to do? Joseph took responsibility. He's an example to us of somebody who took responsibility for the things that God was going to do in his generation. He didn't make excuses. He recognized that life wasn't going to be easy, but he still chose to be accountable and to be responsible. Regardless of the cards he was dealt, his response was always that of what God would want. And Joseph was also an individual that celebrated other generations. He didn't hold any bitterness or any negative feelings towards his brothers when he saw them for what they had done. There are times when I'm still frustrated with my brother for the beatings he would lay on me. But Joseph didn't have that mindset. Joseph rejoiced at the other generations that were in his family. He rejoiced when he found out that his father was still alive. He rejoiced at the fact that he could take care of them, give them a whole new life, and see even more generations come. The past didn't matter to him. And that's the type of attitude that we need to have in our lives. That's the type of mindset that we need to have day to day. When we go out into the chaos that is outside the doors, and we go to our lives where the majority of people are not followers of Christ with us, and we have to deal with all the stuff that they throw at us, all the ways that they talk, not even to us, just around us, all the things that go on, all the commercials that are really horrible commercials that come on during what would otherwise be a really good, healthy program to watch on TV. When all of those situations come about, we need to have the same attitude and the same mindset that Joseph had. And it doesn't matter what the world throws at us. We're going to press on to what God wants. We're gonna be responsible for our generation. We're gonna be responsible for every generation before and after us as well. And we're gonna rejoice with them.